businesses like stability, right? And everyone in this room is craving stability. How seriously are you taking that in the kind of coming days and weeks ahead?
It was what we campaigned on at the general election just 2 years ago, that we would return stability to the economy. And I'm really proud of my record on that, that in just 2 years, we've had six cuts in interest rates, inflation, despite all of the global headwinds, fell in April and held steady in May. And we had the fastest growing economy in the first quarter of this year. And the reason that we have managed to return some semblance of stability to the economy, notwithstanding the shocks from around the world, is because of the fiscal and economic discipline that I have brought back to policy making. And I think that Andy Burnham, who will be the next Prime Minister, has been really clear that he is committed to those fiscal rules. And that is a good thing, because it means that businesses here can be confident that that stability, that rigour to policy making, that tight grip on the public finances, which is essential for getting inflation and interest rates down, will be continued.
I'm really interested to talk a bit more about the fiscal discipline side of things, which obviously has been a big part of your chancellorship. But, you know, you've come out there and addressed the elephant in the room. You're saying that Andy Burnham is going to be the next Prime Minister. Do you want to be his Chancellor?
Well, those would be choices for him. I'm not going to preempt those. When he becomes Prime Minister, he will make those decisions around the top team around him. But I'm not going to preempt that. Those are his decisions.
I might ask a slightly different way. Do you feel you have unfinished business as Chancellor then?
Well, I'm really proud of my record. And I think in those 2 years, if you look at, first of all, those key macro numbers on inflation, on interest rates, on economic growth, the fact that wages have risen faster than inflation for every single month that I've been Chancellor of the Exchequer, the fact that for the first time since 2019, we've got government borrowing below 5% of GDP, 4.2% in the last year, reflects the choices I've made. But much more than that, the changes to the fiscal rules that I made as soon as I became Chancellor unlocked £120 billion of investment into the economy, which has meant we've been able to invest in Sizewell C, a new nuclear power station, small modular reactors in Anglesey, carbon capture and storage in Merseyside and in Teesside. We are expanding airports from Heathrow to Gatwick and beyond, an investment in Northern Powerhouse Rail, not just a promise of investment, but actually money allocated in the spending review, the TransPennine route upgrade, the Oxford-Cambridge growth corridor, and we are lifting more than 500,000 children out of poverty in this parliament. So I'm proud of my record. Yes, I've got more to do. In the budget this year, we've got plans around fiscal devolution, for example, further reforms to business rates that I set out earlier this week, using revenues from properly taxing low-value imports from overseas, for example. So yes, there is more to do, but all of that has to be anchored around that stability that I've returned to the economy.
So where would you say, you obviously know Andy Burnham really well, right? You've said that you're backing him to be the next Prime Minister, and you've gone further today, you've said that he will be the next Prime Minister. Where do your agendas and Andy Burnham's agendas align, would you say?
I backed Andy in 2015 as well to be leader of our party, and I've known him for more than a decade and a half since before I became a Member of Parliament in 2010. So we've worked closely together, but particularly worked closely together the last 2 years. So one of the first big announcements that I made as Chancellor was in regional transport investment, £15.6 billion of regional transport, of which some of that went to Greater Manchester. And we made that announcement at a bus manufacturer in Rochdale, in Andy's old patch as mayor of Greater Manchester. And that money is being used for investment in the B network of buses, but also an extension of the tram system to Southport, to Bury and other parts of Greater Manchester. So we work very closely together on that. We work very closely together on the Transpennine route upgrade, which of course is electrifying trains between Manchester and Leeds and beyond, and now Northern Powerhouse Rail. I'm working closely with Andy on the configuration of that, including the new station at Manchester Piccadilly. So work very closely together on devolution and regional investment. But probably, I think, the area where there's certainly unfinished business is on fiscal devolution. And I set out in last year's budget a consultation, for example, on the visitor levy, which is something that mayoral combined authorities will have responsibility for, moving us more in line with the US and Europe that have small visitor levies on hotel bookings, for example, and then that money being invested in the local area. But beyond that, we are also consulting on devolving some revenues from key taxes, including income tax, but also looking at some key business and land taxes, and devolving that to a local level so that local leaders who know their areas best can decide where that money is going to be spent. And the plan is for this year's budget to set out the detail of how that will work in practice.
Because this is interesting, because we've heard reports that this is the kind of thing Andy Bellin wants to do, right? To devolve income tax, potentially business rates as well, to local areas. It's something that you're instinctively, you want to do too.
Well, we announced it in last year's budget, both the visitor levy and also the consultation around devolving some of the revenues from those key taxes. This is not about increasing those key taxes, but it is saying a proportion of the revenues should be spent, and the decisions on how to spend it at a local level. And that is really crucial for really driving those incentives for growth, but also getting that better value money for taxpayers, because I believe that local leaders have got a better knowledge, better understanding, and also the democratic mandate for decisions in their local area. So I think that's one area where I certainly want to make further progress, and I know that it's an area that Andy is particularly committed to.
You've obviously prioritised, you know, fiscal discipline as Chancellor. It's been a big part of your kind of pitch, if you like. And you said that Andy Burnham was committed to the fiscal rules. I guess the slight issue is that, you know, quite a few Labour MPs are supporting Andy Burnham because he thinks he's going to rip up your fiscal rules, right? What would you say to that?
Andy has been really explicit that he backs those fiscal rules. And the key thing about those fiscal rules, and they are that we pay for day-to-day spending through tax receipts, and that is where the discipline and the rigour really comes in. And then the second is that we get debt down as a share of the economy, and our debt is around 95% of GDP now. But subject to that, we will invest in those things that can improve the longer-term performance of our economy. And that is how I've been able to unlock £120 billion of capital investment into those projects, from energy to transport to data and technology. But also, for the first time ever, on the government's balance sheet, we take into account the value of investment and not just the cost of doing so. And that has unlocked even more for capital investment through the new institution that I created, the National Wealth Fund, but also expanding the remit of UK Export Finance and the British Business Bank, that are now investing directly in businesses and in really exciting infrastructure opportunities.
So do you think that there is capacity to borrow a bit more money to invest? And I'm thinking particularly about defence, right? Because, you know, mm-hmm. people are very concerned about defence spending.
Yeah.
Would that, in your book, be OK?
Well, I'm going to set out, myself, Keir and Dan Jarvis, the defence investment plan ahead of the NATO Ankara summit. But it will involve more money spent more effectively, and it will meet the scale of the challenge. And
the
fiscal rules do allow.
Would that be in the pocket where you can say, actually, you can borrow a bit more money because this is classed as an investment?
Well, that's exactly what my fiscal rules allow. We do treat now, for the first time ever, day-to-day spending and capital spending differently because of the fiscal rules. Up until now, it was all lumped in together as if it didn't make a difference. But of course it makes a difference about whether something boosts our longer-term growth and productivity, which is what capital investment does. So we do have the flexibility within the fiscal rules to do exactly that.
Specifically on defence, though, just to be really clear.
Yes, because most defence spending is capital investment, whether you're building new ships, investing in munitions, but also, what is really crucial is that we get better value for money for our defence spending, which is why a cooperation with our NATO allies, especially our European NATO allies, is really important. And I've already committed to the UK to a multilateral defence mechanism with some of our European partners so that we can purchase military equipment together to get better value for money. At the moment, the US procures one type of tank. In Europe, we procure between different countries 14 different types of tanks. We can get better value for money, but also the multilateral defence mechanism will enable us to stockpile things like munitions off government balance sheets, which again enables us to do more up front because it is capital investment.
The conference theme is growth, right? And, you know, it feels to me like all politicians want to achieve growth, and you guys are no different as well. You promised the fastest growth in the G7. There has obviously been progress, but at the same time, you know, the IMF forecasting UK growth over 2026 as a whole, 0.8%. You know,
they've upgraded that since then, actually. So they upgraded us in the most recent forecast.
To what?
I think 1.1%.
I mean, how...
Well, let's look at my record since I became Chancellor.
Are you happy with... The question was going to be, you know, 1.1%.
No, of course
not.
Would
you like to see more than that?
Yeah, and I have consistently beaten the forecasts for the UK since I became Chancellor. In the first quarter of this year, the most recent data that's available, we were the fastest growing economy in the G7. And you look at the 2 years since I became Chancellor, our economy was the second fastest growing economy in the G7 and the fastest European economy in the G7.
What's the current growth level then?
Well, our economy grew by 0.6% in the first quarter.
This is kind of my point, though, isn't it?
Well, 0.6 times 4 is 2.4% if you continued that for a year, Sophie. So, I mean, that would be an exemplary level of growth for a G7 economy. Are we going to maintain that? No, because of the conflict in the Middle East. It's not a conflict that we started. It's not a conflict we entered. I think I've been pretty clear on and off the record about my views of that conflict. But, of course, it has implications here and at home, which is why I set that target of the fastest growing economy in the G7 as a relative target, because all countries are exposed to shocks. The question is, how do you respond to them? Is your economy secure and resilient enough? Which is why getting control of the public finances is important, but so is investment in our economy, public and private investment. And of that 2.3% growth that we've seen in the 2 years that I've been Chancellor, actually the biggest driver of that is business investment and investment growth,
yeah,
which has grown by 4.9%.
So this is the thing, right? To get growth up and to be a success, you need everyone in this room, right? This is literally the point, right? You need business leaders, you need small businesses, you need big businesses. This is the driver of it. And businesses are telling the BCC, you know, in record numbers, that they are feeling the squeeze. Mm-hmm. And that includes, because of the government's own policies, national insurance contributions, minimum wage increases, business rates, the Employment Rights Act. Do you accept that choices that you've made have impacted growth and also, I guess, the experiences of the people in this room?
Well, businesses are absolutely crucial to growth, and what government can do is provide the environment to encourage that investment. And I have been pleased that the majority of the growth that we've seen has been driven by investment, because that is the way to ensure that growth is sustainable. When I became Chancellor, I think that all businesses in this room would accept that the public finances were in a total mess. There were lots of unfunded commitments made, and the revenues coming in were not enough to meet the spending that was already committed in the economy. So I had to make decisions to increase taxes in my first two budgets. But as a result of that, we have now got, for the first time since 2019, a budget deficit of less than 5% of GDP, the fastest rate of fiscal consolidation in the G7.
Do you accept that those policies that you introduced and the choices you made have negatively impacted businesses and growth?
They are choices, and I stand by those choices, because what is the counterfactual? The counterfactual would be in a government that lost control of the public finances. And we don't have to look to ancient history to know what that means, because it happened just a few years ago when the government made a load of unfunded commitments, and as a result, interest rates and inflation went through the roof. And that was a disaster for businesses and a disaster for ordinary families. I've got back control of the public finances. Inflation came down in April, held steady in May, very different from what is happening in other countries around the world. And we've had six cuts in interest rates, which directly feed into businesses who are borrowing to grow, and directly feed into family finances, which means that people have got more money in their pockets to spend in the economy. Is there more to do to grow the economy? Absolutely there is, whether it's regulatory reform, planning reform, making the tax system fairer, as we've started to do on business rates, but there is more to do, as I've said. But I'm proud of my record as Chancellor. We do have an economy that's growing. We do have an economy where inflation and government borrowing are under control. And for whoever is Prime Minister, be Andy, and whoever is Chancellor in a few weeks' time, will have a better economy that is growing more strongly, that is more secure, that is more stable than the economy that I inherited just 2 years ago.
Some would say, just finally on growth, some would say that, you know, untapping the North Sea would be a way of boosting growth. Is that something that you think is correct?
I've been very clear that I think that the North Sea is a crucial asset for the UK, and that oil and gas will be an important part of our energy mix for years to come. And I'm very keen to make sure that we use that resource to ensure our energy security. And there are decisions to be made shortly on both Rosebank and Jackdaw. Those are quasi-judicial decisions. But in our manifesto 2 years ago, we committed to honour existing licences, and I hope that we do.
You've obviously been very proud of your record, and you've said that you hand the economy over in a better position to whoever becomes the next Prime Minister. Andy Burnham, I guess, is promising change. So he's promising something different. Do you accept that there does need to be change?
Well, we had very poor results in the local elections and the Scottish and Welsh elections just a few weeks ago. So clearly we need to do more to connect to the country, to tell a better story of what we've done in government, but also set out the vision for where we want the country to go. That is what Andy will be able to provide as our next Prime Minister. He is a great communicator. He's got a great track record in delivering in Manchester. And I've no doubt that he will bring that to the position of Prime Minister. And I look forward to working with him in whatever capacity.
Just on that, obviously, he's going to choose a Chancellor. It might be you. It might not be you. What would your advice be to anyone in the future taking on the role as Chancellor?
I'm not sure if anyone wants my advice, but my advice would be, you've got a brilliant set of officials at the Treasury who will back you if you are clear about what you want to do. And I've been very clear about what I wanted to achieve as Chancellor. I wanted to restore stability to the economy. I wanted to boost investment, both public and private, into the economy. And I wanted to change how the economy works with a regulatory burden that is fairer and more efficient, with a planning system that actually allows things to get built in our country. I'm really proud of my record, and I hope that whoever is Chancellor in the future, whenever that future may be, sticks to what I'm doing, because it is beginning to bear fruit, and we are seeing that investment return to the economy, that growth return to the economy, and crucially that stability so that businesses can plan and invest for the future.
Whatever happens, you're going to be, you know, part of history as the first ever female Chancellor. How would you like the history bits to remember, you know, Rachel Reeves as Chancellor? What's your single biggest achievement so far?
Well, when I became Chancellor of the Exchequer, the first speech I gave was in the atrium of the Treasury, and I said in that speech that I would judge my time in office a success if ordinary children from working class backgrounds had more opportunities than when I became Chancellor, and whether women and girls felt that there should be no ceiling on their ambition. It'll be up to others to judge whether I've achieved my goals, but I'm very proud of what I've done and believe I have.
Rachel Reeves, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, take care.